Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello, good afternoon, and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley, your host for the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate here on Premier Christian Radio every Saturday afternoon as part of Faith Explored. Though, it's actually not a Christian and a non-Christian this week. It's two Christians, but a really interesting dialogue that they're having on two very different perspectives on creation, evolution and theology. So we'll be introducing those in a moment's time. If you want to keep listening after Unbelievable today, the profile between 4 and 5 presented by Sam Hales, he'll be speaking to Mike Pilavachu, who's had an amazing ministry running Soul Survivor, a youth organisation and festival and lots of other things as well here in the UK, and his book Naturally Supernatural. Natural on putting the miraculous back into our everyday walk with God. That's between 4 and 5 this afternoon. But if you're listening online, then you'll know that you can get Unbelievable as a podcast. Lots of people listen that way. And if you'd like to join them and perhaps spread the love by telling other people about it, rating us on iTunes and that kind of thing, do check out all the links from the webpage today. Today's programme there, you can find more links as well to other articles and features. premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. And links there, of course, to this year's conference. So we were able to announce that last week. The ticketing is now open. Unbelievable Conference 2017, Why Christ? Discovering how Jesus is the answer to life, the universe and everything. Back at the Brewery in London, a great venue, on Saturday the 13th of May. Hopefully I'll see you there because we've had such fun in the last several years at this conference. Early bird tickets available. Going to be joined by people like John Lennox, Andy Bannister, Beth Grove, Jeremiah J. Johnston, Ruth Jackson, Jamie Cutteridge, and many more besides. More people to be added to that speaking roster. If you want details and see about whether you want to book yourself in, perhaps bring a group. We're doing group discounts as usual. Go to premier.org.uk/whychrist. That's premier.org.uk/whychrist. But right now, it's time to get into this week's discussion.
You're unbelievable.
Well, on today's programme, we're asking, should Christians reject theistic evolution? Wayne Rossiter was an atheist biologist who experienced an adult conversion to Christianity. Well, he also changed his mind about evolution, and in his recent book, The Shadow of Oz, he claims that Christians have been sold a theological, philosophical and biological fallacy when it comes to those who promote the idea that Christianity is perfectly compatible with Darwinian evolution. Well, joining me to discuss this issue today is Dennis Alexander, a geneticist and Christian who believes in theistic evolution. Indeed, Dennis helped to found the Faraday Institute in Cambridge, an organisation part of which is the aim to show the complementarity of evolution and Christian faith. So Dennis is, in a sense, precisely the kind of voice that Wayne critiques in his book. So I'm looking forward to what I'm sure will be a gracious interaction, but nonetheless one with significant differences of opinion on the programme today. And as ever, if you want to get in touch with the show, we'll make sure to give the ways to do that a little bit later on in the programme. So both Dennis and Wayne, welcome along to the programme today.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
It's great to have you both. Dennis, you've been on before, so I'll come back to you in a moment's time. We'll introduce the newer guest for today, Wayne. Wayne, welcome along to the programme. I had a couple of people get in touch with me saying you should have Wayne on the show. He's got some interesting things to say. And so here we are. You're on the program, but you've got a rather fascinating backstory, Wayne. Do you want to tell us about what you grew up with in terms of faith or lack of faith and how things changed for you?
Sure. I mean, I don't detail it too much in the book. And in fact, to be honest with you, parts of it are a little bit painful to me. I'm one of those people who didn't sort of drop to my knees in joy coming to God. It was more of a painful dragging towards him, reluctantly and very suddenly. But yeah, as a child, I mean, I grew up in an evangelical Christian family, and it was a busy family. And by the time I hit high school, you know, we weren't really attending church as regularly. And I would say I kind of, at that point, was lukewarm as a Christian. And then I went to college and was presented with things that I hadn't been taught in high school and hadn't been told to me in church. And it took me all of a year to basically disavow my faith in God. And I spiraled towards being what I refer to as a cantankerous atheist after that. I mean, I was trained up properly in the Dawkins-style approaches, and I sort of made it my job to humiliate Christians when possible and try to convert them out of their waywardness back to the light. Mm. And then in 2008, about halfway through my PhD, so I did a master's in between there, and about halfway through my PhD at Rutgers University on a snowy night in early March, I was basically just brought to my knees and humbled, very much in a sort of Saul to Paul way. It's as if my entire worldview was just flipped on its head. And it was very emotionally difficult for me, but I basically saw the vapidness of atheism and the hopelessness of it. That came first. I didn't initially have faith in God. I just had the hopelessness of atheism. And so then, little by little, I started actually giving serious attention and seriously reading Christian thinkers, and came to find out that they had a lot of really good ideas and really good arguments that I hadn't heard, and that I didn't have very good arguments against God. So basically, it's been a growing process since 2008.
Wow. Which, you know, in relative terms, is relatively recently, really, that you came to faith in that way, Wayne, having been, you know, as you say, a cantankerous atheist up to that point. I mean, how, obviously, you had a very a big change of mind when it came to God, and you obviously became a Christian in due course as well. How was that kind of going alongside your science? I mean, presumably up to that point, you'd used science as one of the tools to bash Christians, saying, you know, your faith isn't compatible with science and so on. So did your relationship with science and the evolution that you were obviously studying and researching begin to change as well?
Well, I don't know if we'll have time to get into some of these details today, but yeah, essentially, in some ways, it actually liberated my thinking. Because if you're operating solely within a Dawkins-style Darwinian evolution scenario, you're really cheating yourself the more robust understanding of where we are in evolutionary theory and just how many competing or at least supplementary and ancillary ideas there are out there. And I was able to engage some of those because I think that there are many ways in which evolution, or at least certain theories in evolution, are compatible with theism. And I came to doubt I don't doubt the existence of Darwinian evolution, but I came to doubt its efficacy, its ability to do the job that we claim it does. I guess I'll say the nice thing is that I did some molecular biology studying rattlesnake venom evolution in my master's. And after that, I started working with parasite transmission and disease, and I'm basically an ecologist. So to be honest, I don't really have to interact with those things too often in the field of ecology. If we're trying to save some endangered species, we don't really sit around and talk about its phylogenetic history too much.
We'll come to the substance of the book in a moment's time. Let me first of all, though, introduce my other guest on the program today. That's Dennis Alexander. As I say, a geneticist, a Christian. He probably would describe himself as a theistic evolutionist, although I'll let him decide how he labels himself in a moment's time, but is the emeritus director of the Faraday Institute now, having stepped back a little bit, though you say you keep on trying to retire, Dennis, but never quite managed to fully. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Yes, indeed. Well, my story is also in similar to Wayne in the sense that I was brought up in an evangelical Christian home, and I can't remember any time that I didn't really believe in God. I became a Christian at the age of 13 when I fully understood that this was something that was dependent on my own personal decision. I wasn't somehow automatically a Christian by having Christian parents and so on. So by the time I went to Oxford and studied biochemistry for 4 years, I was already a committed Christian. So as things went along, I simply, if you like, baptized my biology into my Christian faith, into my Christian worldview, and that includes evolutionary biology. So I have to say, I can't remember any time in my life when I thought that evolution was particularly a problem for Christians. My mother was a physiologist. I was surrounded by many Christian biologists who had no problem with evolution. So, and I think probably the history of the church, indeed, in Europe in general and in Britain, Great Britain in particular, has been a little bit different in terms of the history of the debate about creation and evolution. So all the evangelical leaders that I was familiar with and associated with as an undergraduate were people who wouldn't think at all there was any problem, particularly in evolution.
You never picked up that was a going theological concern, by and large, with, I don't know, the evangelicals of perhaps, you know, that era, John Stott and others. It never felt like they had a real issue with an evolutionary understanding of the development of life.
Well, that's right. Yeah. So, for example, so let me confess, I was an undergraduate in Oxford in the 1960s, so a few years ago, and I was very much involved in the Christian Union there and all that kind of thing. And to be honest, I never even heard of creationism, and I don't think anyone else had either. We didn't even know what it was. So it wasn't a question that there was some debate about creationism. It's just that it wasn't on a horizon. And I didn't actually knowingly meet, as I consciously remember, my first sort of signed up creationist till I was in my late 20s. And by that time, I was overseas, and this was an American guy from the States. And then I began to realize that the history of evangelicalism in relation to evolution has been very different in the States, probably compared to Britain.
And do you sort of, I guess, in terms of distinguishing where you do stand now that you're aware, obviously, and have been for many years of the diversity that exists within Christendom on this, do you tend to call yourself a theistic evolutionist, or is there another label you might use?
Yeah, the slight problem with theistic evolution is that it means many different things to different people. Okay, so it needs to be unpackaged a bit. I quite like the term evolutionary creationist or creationism. I quite like that. I know some people in the States use that term. That's fine. I think whatever term we use, we probably, you know, you can't assume too much just by the label. You really have to unpackage it and have a discussion. Well, what do you mean by that? You know, so, and, you know, we don't have theistic accountants and theistic car mechanics and even theistic radio presenters in terms of label. You know, we don't go around labeling. So we have to think about where that term comes from, actually, and that's quite an interesting story. Yeah.
Well, let's come back to you, Wayne. Just start to unpack for us what your main issue is with theistic evolution. I mean, I think really there are a few different angles from which you have a problem with it, if you like, theologically, philosophically, and I think biologically. Now, I think maybe for the sake of time and what we can do in today's program, we won't go too deep into the biological issues you have with it. But by and large, in terms of where you would describe yourself now, would it be fair to say you're something like in the intelligent design camp, or would you have a different way of describing it?
Well, I'm certainly, I know those folks. I interact with them. I mean, a couple of them endorse my book. Am I in that camp? I'm certainly adjacent to that camp.
Right.
I mean, we could talk about that. I mean, the thing is, my critique is really on theistic evolution, and in that sense, doesn't require me to take a stance on intelligent design. I mean, I could sit here as a young Earth creationist or an atheist and have the same view.
I've got a few quotes in front of me from your book, and I think this one sort of, to some extent, summarizes a lot of the issue you have with theistic evolution. And you say here in the book, the Darwinian paradigm stands opposed to the classical understanding of a Christian God. The reason is plain and obvious. Something cannot be intended and unintended at the same time. Okay, unpack that a bit for us. What's your fundamental problem then with theistic evolution?
Well, I mean, if you'll allow me to do it, I'll back up one step, and then I'll hit that as I come through. I think more broadly, from what I can tell, theistic evolution is an attempt to find complete harmony between science and Christianity. And so this includes, you know, cosmology, astronomy, geology, biology, whatever. And so then you get these sorts of statements. Take, for example, the theologian John Haught. He says, you know, and I'm quoting, an ultimate theological account of in no way interferes with purely scientific explanations. And I would just say, well, of course, no purely scientific explanation includes God.
Hmm.
And so Haught has to go on and add that, you know, we look in vain for God in the history of nature or in human history if we're looking for special divine intervention. You know, this is a natural unfolding that doesn't contain supernatural exchange with God. This is creation allowed to create itself, as Polkinghorne put it. And so then we can get to the specifics of, you might ask what that does to things like petitionary prayer and you know, miracles of the Bible and Jesus, which, you know, birth, death, resurrection is never going to be compatible with a purely scientific explanation. But leaving that aside, you get to something like Darwinian evolution. Okay, well, if ever there was something that looks godless as a scientific explanation, it's Darwinian evolution. I mean, here you're saddled with you know, a wandering and protracted process. It's ceaseless and unending. It's driven by chance mutations that are funneled through brutish death, and then on top of that, these cataclysmic extinction events. It, as far as we can tell, doesn't have any forethought. It can't work towards intended goals in the future. And so, yeah, that's how I arrive at this. How exactly can God use this to make an intended thing? How can we be intended and unintended at the same time?
Because fundamentally, as far as you can see, the whole point of the evolutionary account is that it's just taking whatever works in the environment. It's kind of making the best. And there's no, you know, at a scientific level, you can't speak of purpose, of any end goal. Whereas obviously the Christian is going to be talking about those things. So in your view, how normally does the theistic evolutionist put those together in your view? Is it simply a sort of a layer on top of the scientific explanation, which the atheist can therefore simply dismiss and say, well, I have no need of that hypothesis?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think of just by a quick analogy, I think of Jim Stump writing for BioLogos, a big think tank for theistic evolution. He says, you know, did God create the Hawaiian Islands? Yes. But we think that there's a perfectly natural explanation for that creation. Okay, well, if you're a geologist, I'm not sure why you would ever go to God when you don't need it. No. You don't need that hypothesis to explain this. And particularly when you're working with something that is at its very heart considered to be stochastic or chance. I'm not sure how you could, I don't know how you can play the lottery fairly and have intended outcomes. And that sort of becomes the heart of the problem. And of course you ask, how do theistic evolutionists deal with it? Well, there are several nuanced ways. Stephen Barr will say that he's pulling every string. In fact, none of it's random at all. God is literally doing every one of those mutations. Alvin Plantinga has done some deep work on this, and I've just recently been sort of discussing some of his stuff on my own blog, where he'll say, well, it looks random to us, but we're not in a position to say it's metaphysically random in the sense that God can't be somehow in there doing it. I think that the problem is that the definitions that they must accept as scientific theory are incompatible with the idea of God actually directing things for any goal. I just don't see it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to let Dennis respond in just a moment's time. First of all, though, just a quick reminder, as I promised earlier, that if you want to get in touch about today's program, perhaps have your say via email, then do get in touch. unbelievable@premier.org.uk is one of the ways to do that. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Get in touch with your message at unbelievablejb for the Twitter account, facebook.com/unbelievablejb to follow the show on Facebook. From the website, you can find links to both my guests today, Dennis Alexander and Wayne Rossiter, and to Wayne's book, A Shadow of Oz. And I'll make sure there are links to the Faraday Institute as well. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable for today's program and those links. And of course, you can leave your thoughts on underneath today's program there as well.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So we're asking today, should Christians reject or embrace theistic evolution? Wayne Rossiter says reject, because he was an atheist. And he says theistic evolution kind of is playing into the hands of the atheist, because really it leaves no role for God in some ways. Well, joining me in studio to debate that, Dennis Alexander, who is, you could say, a theistic evolutionist. He sometimes calls himself an evolutionary creationist, just for fun. And he's got his own book as well. Do you want to tell us what the name of your book is, Dennis, that might be helpful for people who want an alternative take on all of this?
Yes, it's called Creation or Evolution? Do We Have to Choose? Second edition, 2014, published by Monarch Press.
Remember when we had you the first time you it was published, and we had a really good discussion. It's still in the Unbelievable archives. I'll make sure there's a link from today's show to it. But hearing everything that Wayne had to say there, I can understand, you know, his point of view. For him, it's easy to dismiss God if you're going on this. You know, if all you need is the scientific explanation, then people will say, you're kind of just inventing something extra, Dennis, by positing a God behind this process, which by all accounts appears to be a perfectly naturalistic process. It doesn't seem to involve any purpose or design or process that could have been driven by a God. So what's your take on this? Why do you feel that it doesn't militate against faith in God?
Yes, thanks very much. All good questions. I think I'll do what Wayne did and is take one step back before picking up precisely. Of course, as a Christian, a lot depends on what your theology of creation is, and I seek to take my theology of creation from the biblical text, which, of course, the theology of creation is all over the Bible, not just in the first few chapters of Genesis. But there, clearly, we see a transcendent God, that is, a God who is over and above the created order that he's brought into existence and continues to uphold. So we're not, Christians are not pantheists. They don't believe that God is part of the creation in that sense. But at the same time, there's a whole lot in the Bible, in the Old Testament and the New Testament, about God's what we call immanence in creation. That is to say that God is thoroughly involved in everything that happens. So we have this idea that originally came down from Thomas Aquinas. You know, you've got God as the primary cause, and the secondary cause is all those aspects of material aspects, energy aspects of the creation that God uses to bring about his intentions and purposes. So in other words, as far as the Bible is concerned, you see this especially in great Psalms like Psalm 104 and so on. You see it when Paul was writing to Colossians in chapter 1, where he says that in Christ all things exist. You see it when Paul is preaching to the Athenians in Acts 17, when he says, in him we live and move and have our being. He's talking about human life. And so you get a very strong sense in the Bible that what we mean by creation is that we are all part of God's created order. This is, as we look around us, this is what we see. We see a creation. So then what is the task of scientists? Well, we try and just understand it as best we can. And sometimes it's pretty feeble, and other times we do a pretty good job. And clearly there are some theories that are better than others explaining what we see. But all that scientists can do, whether they're atheists or Christians or whatever, it doesn't matter. All they can do within the Christian worldview is to seek to understand and describe God's activity in the created order. So that's a seamless cloth of God's creation. It's like the author in relation to a book in that way.
And we shouldn't necessarily expect that the scientist, the Christian scientist, can point to the evolutionary process and say, there you go, atheist, there's your evidence that God exists. It's that God is bigger than the process itself. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well, I think generally, of course, this is the whole thing of people call natural theology, and the question is, to what degree can we derive the existence of God or even the characteristics of God by looking at the world around us, by looking at the natural world? And of course, there's a range of views on that within the Christian community. I would want to say, you know, the biggest evidence, if you like, for God is simply looking at the intelligibility of the universe and its properties, the fact that it's orderly. I would see evolution as a very orderly process, by the way, very constrained, and so on. So it's when we look at the reproducibility that we need in science of experiments, when we look at the intelligibility of the world that's described by the wonderful physical laws of the universe that we have, and so on. So that, to me, is certainly consistent with the idea of the existence of a God who is the mind behind the universe. Okay. Yeah,
it's enough then, it appears, for Dennis for this to be consistent with his view of God, and to view God as immanent in all of creation. And if God has chosen to create using a sort of, you know, what can be seen as a natural process of evolution, that's the way God chose to do it. What's your response to all of that, Wayne?
Well, I mean, I think I kind of have two immediately. The first is that this is one of the things that always, I'm very concerned about this approach, because effectively what this has just done is make God immune to any discovery. If you begin with the assumption that God is immanent throughout his creation, and that he's the grand, you know, background, the backdrop that sustains all of these things, if that's your assumption to begin with, then of course whatever you find will be compatible with that God, which means that no matter how horrific or brutal or cruel or pitiless and indifferent the universe may appear, you will still say God did it. And I guess when you're at that point and there's nothing anybody could ever show you to dissuade you, I don't know how that's different than if I was, you know, sort of chatting with a Scientologist and he says, well, no matter what I discover about the observable world, I know Zeno did it because I believe in Zeno. That in itself, I think, becomes, I mean, this is the problem that atheists pound us on. Peter Boghossian calls this doxastic closure. There's nothing you can say to penetrate them. Now, I would just say, now, even if you just go ahead and accept that, to get back to the specifically Darwinian evolution, if you're going to say that God's way of creating is Darwinian evolution, then you have to understand that the mutations of Darwin's mechanism are responsible for ghastly diseases, malformations, and deaths. And before we sort of just blithely shrug it off, I'd ask people, your audience, to consider a disease like harlequin-type ichthyosis. They'll have to Google it. But I'll tell you about it. It's a single mutation to a keratin-forming gene in chromosome 2. It causes the child to be born with a thick layer of skin, an armor, around encompassing their body. And this armor cracks whenever they move. So the baby is born a bloody mess. Okay. The joints do not form properly. Typically, the baby is born without eyes. If it has eyes, the eyelids are everted. Other cranial deformities come with the package. And ultimately, through continual and painful cracking, there becomes infection of the blood, and the baby will eventually die. Now, as a parent, I still remember the joy and excitement of holding my child for the first time. And I just want to think, if you're really going to say God uses mechanisms like this to create, you're going to have to look that parent in the eye and say, this is what God intended, and this is how his mechanism works.
Okay.
Well, and I find that to be a deeply problematic problem. I mean,
you've raised a huge area. One, in a sense, which I'm sure you need to respond from whatever point, you know, theological point of view you come from on this as well, Wayne, but I will give Dennis a chance to respond in just a moment's time, but we'll go to a break first, because time is against us and I want to make sure you've got opportunity to respond, Dennis. We're asking today on the program, should Christians reject or embrace theistic evolution? Wayne Rossiter and Dennis Alexander are my guests. Wayne's book is The Shadow of Oz. He claims Christians have been sold a theological, philosophical, biological fallacy when it comes to the promotion of Christianity being perfectly compatible with Darwinian evolution. Dennis Alexander takes the opposite view. He says there is no problem with putting those two things together, and he'll be responding to Wayne in a moment's time in the second part of today's program. Do come back again for Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley.
Deliver us from evil. In the February edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we open up the real-life world of exorcism and deliverance ministry, separating fact from the Hollywood fiction of demonic possession. We also talk to the world's most influential Bible scholar, N.T. Wright, on why he's returning to the revolutionary cross of Christ. You'll learn about the six lies our worship music tells us and how we can fix them. And we'll hear from the family law court judge delivering his evidence on why we need to save marriage for the good of the UK. All that plus much more. Ask for your free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's Unbelievable. We've got a scientific, theological, philosophical discussion today on the programme. I'll be reintroducing my guests in a moment's time. Don't forget that if you want to listen back to today's show, share it with a friend, subscribe yourself, then go to the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can find links to Wayne Rossiter and Dennis Alexander, my guests on today's show there. You can find many past programmes as well, links to the podcast and much more besides. Information on the Unbelievable Conference for 2017 as well, Saturday the 13th of May. A little later on in today's show, we'll hear some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme. And don't forget that straight after Unbelievable, at 4 this afternoon, you can hear The Profile, another Christian talks about their walk of faith and life. Well, today on the show, we're discussing what is often a heated and controversial topic, evolution, creation, and the theology of both. Wayne Rossiter has, after becoming a Christian, an adult convert to Christianity with a background in biology, he came to severely doubt the consensus view around evolution in science. And he came to see, in his view, that the Christian promotion of theistic evolution was actually at odds with a proper understanding of God, really. And Dennis Alexander, my guest here in the studio, who has promoted the harmony of Christianity and evolution for a long time. He was one of the founders of the Faraday Institute in Cambridge, now the emeritus director there, says actually we shouldn't be scared of seeing God's hand at work through the natural process of evolution. Now, the point that we came to in that last section there, Dennis, was Wayne saying, how can you speak of a God who would use a process like this that entails terrible suffering? You know, this particular condition he described that sometimes babies are born with. And obviously for Wayne, that the problem with that is that, well, that's kind of all part and parcel of the evolutionary process. If that's the process God uses to create, then he intended for there to be these terrible consequences, effectively, of the process.
Yeah, so obviously, when we come to the whole question of suffering and pain, this is a huge topic, and it's a sensitive one, and one I think we all need to tread fairly delicately through. I mean, I myself have spent quite a big chunk of my life in cancer research and also working out in the American University Hospital in genetic research, and, you know, I've seen some pretty terrible diseases in kids that are similar to those that Wayne just described for us. So I think we have to understand, you know, there aren't any simple answers to this, and there aren't any simple answers by atheists any more than there are from Christians. So let's not pretend, you know, this is some straightforward thing. But I think what we have to understand is that it is true that if you have carbon-based life, then there are certain entailments of that. And if you like, you can draw a sort of big table with all the positives of that on one side and all the negatives on the other. I mean, even those of us who just had our breakfast or our lunch or whatever, you know, that tends to generate free oxygen radicals that cause mutations. Even the normal things we do in our daily life, good things, that we have food and so on. So there's a negative side to that as well, you know, that there is a greater risk for some disease or something. So when you look at carbon-based life, you find it's like a package deal where everything comes along together as part of this package. Pain is part of the package. We can't do without pain. Those who are born without pain usually die quite young if they don't get medical care, very sadly, and so on. So pain is really essential for biological organisms that have somewhat developed nervous systems and so on. So the question is, you know, would there be another way? I mean, clearly existence is extremely costly. Carbon-based life is very costly. You know, it costs the whole evolutionary process. That's unbelievably costly. So we might feel we want to give back our ticket. You know, we don't want that system. Okay, it'd be better not to have it. Why don't we have another way? Mm. And of course, the thing is, well, we don't know there is another way. We don't know there's another way to get to human beings who have free will, who have genuine choice about whether they want to respond to God's love or not. So getting to that place of having big frontal lobes and a big brain and the ability to choose and have moral abilities and to respond to God's love and to be humanity in the world, that is a very costly process. And you're absolutely right, Wayne, that mutations can cause this wonderful variation that we all have, that we're all different, you know, that we're not all identical, even identical twins are not identical and so on. So we need variation. Even if you don't believe in evolution, you have to believe in that. If you just look around the world and people around you, you need genetic variation if you're going to have variation in humans. But, you know, the negative side is, yep, they cause cancer. I've had cancer. I know that genetics causes cancer. So, and I've spent a lot of my life in researching on cancer. So I think part of the answer, not the whole answer, part of the answer is we need to get on with it and subdue the earth. That means subduing cancer and doing research and putting our backs into really doing something about that.
I mean, before you respond to Dennis's take on that, Wayne, what would your response be as a Christian to the parent who faces that awful scenario of their child being born with this condition? I mean, will it depend somewhat on how you think God, you know, God works, whether he's in any way to blame for the process that brought about a scenario where that particular disease exists?
Right. I mean, I certainly have a few things in response, but in terms of my own view, I think that a large number of Christians, historically speaking as well, would point to these sorts of things as consequences of a fallenness. And as I've read Dennis, he essentially has no physical aspect of the fall. For him, it's completely spiritual. And so in this sense, there's nothing actually wrong about the creation as it is, which, of course, begs the question how he then perceives a new creation that won't have all of these things. So he says we don't know if there is such a situation. Well, of course he knows. He's already written on this. There's a new creation that won't have these things. Mm. I would also just point out that there can be beings that have identities that don't require this sort of makeup. We have angels, and they have names and identities and personalities. And now he can maybe, I don't know his view on that. Maybe he rejects that. But it seems to me that to just wish on the unknown and say, well, we don't know, God couldn't do anything but this. This is the only way. Mm. Well, we don't know that he couldn't. That's just wishing on the unknown. That's just another sort of layer to the... I mean, anytime you claim to not know the mind of God, then it simply means that. You don't know the mind of God. It's not an argument in your favor. It just means you don't know. I think that would be a couple of comments. Yeah. But.
So for you then, just to make this clear, your take on this, Wayne, is that all of those sorts of evils that we see in nature and so on, that the atheist would just say, well, that's just the happenstance of the way evolution happens and whatnot. Whereas Dennis would say it's a package deal to be the people we are, capable of relationship with God. We kind of have to take the good with the bad in the process. Your view on this, though, Wayne, is no. Something got subverted in the fall, and those things that we see that we can say are terrible things, they're not the way it was meant to be. We're not seeing in front of us this evolutionary process, God's perfect kind of plan being played out. It's actually something else is happening here. I mean, am I kind of summarizing where you're coming from?
Well, and I think Dennis is exactly right. I mean, there's a reason why the problem of evil and suffering has lived on in perpetuity, right? It's still here. I'm writing a foreword for a person writing a book on this topic right now, and it hasn't gone away. There are many different ways to deal with it, and they're all uncomfortable, frankly. I think they're all uncomfortable. And so what I would just say is, if in the end it turns out that I meet God and it is made clear to me that this was the necessary way, that kind of human suffering and even animal suffering was the only way to get this done, then I will just simply say, you'll have to forgive me because I do not understand such horrific methods. I can't rationalize why an innocent child would suffer in the way I described, or their family. And if that was as a way of creating, right? And I think that gets, this is a sort of stupid analogy, because a lot of times I'll ask theistic evolutionists, so what exactly did God do? This is something Greg Kokel's also asked repeatedly. What exactly did God do? And the response is everything. Mm. And I say, well, if I kick my dog, did God kick my dog? Now, that sounds like a silly question, but it's actually a very important question. The question is there anything going on in this world that is not his intention? Hmm. And I think you can't have fallenness of any sort unless you have these sorts of things at play. And the question is, where do you draw the line? And I honestly won't tell you where, because I'm not sure. But
right.
I think that's the question that must be asked.
Okay. Do you want to respond, Dennis?
Yes, clearly there's lots of questions here. I mean, I think, you know, that actually if we go back to Thomas Aquinas a bit in the 13th century and follow Neo-Thomist theology, that might be able help us a little bit here. I mean, what you just cited with about kicking your dog and so on. So in Neo-Thomist theology, the idea is, and I would say it's a very biblical theology too, that the idea is that God gives real integrity to his created order. It's not autonomy, but integrity. In other words, God causes creatures to be causes. God causes creatures to be causes. So causality, you kicking your dog, that's a genuine causality by you. But your whole being, the whole material order in biblical thought is upheld and sustained in Christ. It's sustained by God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. Actually Darwin had the same question. One day he wrote to Asa Gray and he had a reply from somebody else. But and Darwin's question was, well, when the swallow, it was a bird, swallows a particular gnat, is that somehow designed by God that bird should do that on that particular day? And so his Christian correspondent very sensibly said, no, that it's about intentionality. So in other words, the created order has its own integrity, and there are particular things that God wills and intentions that should be different. They should be A rather than B. But things like, you kick your dog one day, well, that's your free will anyway, but, you know, let's take a bird, that's easier. If the bird swallows a particular gnat on Monday rather than Tuesday, you know, that's not part of God's design intentionality. That's simply that God has given the created order its own functional integrity. And I think that's an important distinction. If I can just pick up as well on the point, you mentioned the fall. I actually do think there are profound physical effects of the fall, but they're not, as it were, the changing of the laws of nature and the sudden introduction of disease that wasn't there before, and suddenly you get genetic mutations that cause diseases in children that weren't there before. I don't see any biblical evidence for that whatsoever. However, there clearly are physical effects in the sense that Adam and Eve, that God gave the command to care for the earth, and they disobey God, and they stop looking after God properly. The earth, they're cursed, the earth is cursed, and thistles and thorns come along, and all kinds of bad things happen. But it's the fault of humanity in the Genesis account of not caring for the earth properly, and that's picked up in Romans 8, where you've got the sons of God, you know, angels are longing for the sons of God to be revealed. Why? Because, you know, one reason, they're going to be looking after the earth properly. This is what God's intention, the original intention, was for that. So I think its physical effects of the fall are very potent, but they're mediated, if I might say, through fallen humanity. And that's why, of course, we have an environmental crisis today.
Do you want to respond, Wayne?
Well, I think that casts a fairly narrow... I mean, first of all, I'm happy to hear the idea that Dennis is thinking that there are things that happen that aren't God's will or his intention. I'd still make a distinction between the idea of being a sustaining God that allows, basically acts as a table upon which things happen, and whether or not he's actually doing those things, which I think is the pivotal question. That remains the pivotal question in these things. And you know, and I'll just say that there are alternatives to this. Now, I actually don't completely agree with Alvin Plantinga on this, but he has at least offered a solution to natural evil in the sense that just as we fall and there might be some effects of that, he suggests that there's a possibility that there's a demonic aspect to these sorts of things. Now, again, I don't actually ascribe to that, but I'm just saying there are serious thinkers who have these alternatives that would actually greatly reinterpret the way we understand natural evils, especially as they're played out in Darwinian evolution. So, in that sense, God is really no longer responsible for that. You can't say that's his way of creating anymore. And I think Plantinga would make a distinction between him poking around and causing certain things to happen to guide that movement. And then the other stuff is just sort of happening, but it's not necessarily what he intended.
Yeah, Wayne, I think also, it's important that we distinguish, isn't it, between moral evil that is caused by human free will. I mean, I absolutely believe that humans have genuine free will, and that's written on every page of the Bible, or assumed on every page of the Bible, I would want to say. So there is real moral evil. That's our fault. That's not God's fault. I mean, God didn't cause the Holocaust. God didn't cause the war in Syria. I mean, this is human evil at work every day of the week. And that's all we see. So I do think we may need to make a distinction between that and what we sometimes call natural evils, although I'm not even happy with that phrase because it's confusing. But that's all the stuff that we don't like, that we see out in the rest of the world. We see earthquakes happening, and we see, you know, tectonic plates moving, and we see, of course, animal suffering and pain. And that's in a different category. That's not their fault. I don't think we don't take animals to court when they kill somebody else. So, right. So I think that distinction is important.
Yeah. That brings up actually a couple interesting points, and I concede that I'm not really well read on your view on Adam and Eve, but as I understand it, you don't accept any sort of literal first two beings. You accept a hominid evolution and some chain of primate ancestry, and so with respect to moral culpability, I think that's actually a really interesting question for theistic evolutionists again, because you sort of have to envision some population of ancestral primates. And one of them births an individual, and God looks and says, that one I will hold morally culpable. That one I will judge. And I find that really sort of difficult to understand or even rationalize. I do want to say one more quick thing, because I'm sure you'll have a response to that. But you mentioned, you know, natural evils and tectonic plate movement. Another curiosity, and I don't have a view. I'm just curious about this. Given that we've had massive extinction events, cataclysmic things throughout the history of the planet, it seems to me that, say, for example, if, you know, the mega volcano underneath Yellowstone blows its top tomorrow morning, it's perfectly within the natural workings of this process ordained by God that we would be utterly erased, just as other large numbers, 80% in one case of living things, were just erased. And I wonder how that fits in theologically. Is it, do you think that these processes have now been held at bay by God, or do you think that it's possible that we could see a time in which humans don't exist?
Quite a few questions there, but in a sense, yeah. Coming back to this thing of, well, is this all intentioned, or is it as random as it looks from the fact that, you know, there are mass extinctions in the evolutionary history of the Earth, and you know, it's possible that could happen to humans. Or do you think, no, God is kind of, as Wayne says, holding that back, or now that we're here, he's kind of got more of a guiding hand on things than there was before?
We have a rainbow. That's the great promise, the rainbow. Just keep looking at the rainbow, Wayne. But no, you know, I think the point is that okay, so hovering behind this is the whole issue, obviously, that you've dwelt on a little bit. That's the issue of chance and randomness and evolutionary process. Actually, most evolutionary biologists I know would not see evolution as a chance process in the popular sense of the word. Now, of course, it's a difficult word, and it's a slippery word, okay, and randomness is too. So random simply means in evolutionary biology, as you know, that genetic variation happens without any mindfulness of what's going to happen to the organism for its good or ill. Okay, genetic variation just happens. That's what randomness means. As it happens, if you think about randomness mathematically in the genome, it is not mathematically random. I mean, there are clusters, hotspots of genetic mutation, and there's a huge amount of data on that and so forth. So a lot depends on, you know, how one understands that whole thing. But personally, I you know, clearly there are many different ways in which we could have got here, but the fact of the matter is that it's extremely constrained. Convergence is a very dominant feature of the evolutionary process, where the same adaptations keep popping up all over the place. And, you know, eyes have popped up, evolved separately in independent evolutionary lineages more than 20 times, compound and camera eyes. And so, you know, when you actually look at the process, it's a very ordered process, and the particular reasons why animals, the shape they are, and there are laws like Kleiber's law, you know, which is an example of an allometric law in biology, where, you know, the relationship of metabolic energy and size and so forth is very constrained, remarkably so, and so forth.
And in saying that, though, are you saying God somehow intended that constraint? That I mean, are you happy to say evolution meant for us to be here, or can you only say that of God, but that God set the natural laws that evolution plays within, and so we were bound to be here, or something like us was bound to be here?
Well, I think you get different answers if you're thinking, looking at God's purposes and plans as revealed in the Bible, when clearly we're meant to be here.
Sure.
Okay, so that's pretty clear. Now, if you just want to start bottom up from the biology, then even then, well, you end up with someone like Simon Conway Morris, who says inevitable humans in a lonely universe. That's the title of his book. And biologically, it does look as if something like us is going to happen, and it wouldn't be surprising to find something like us maybe on other planets. So it depends if you're looking specifically through the eyes of God's revelation in the Bible, or if you're simply looking bottom up in biology. And I think you come to similar conclusions, but the first one has a lot more conviction behind it.
I'll let Wayne come back. I do want to revisit Adam and Eve, though, because I'd be interested to know whether Wayne got your take on that correct as well. But Wayne, I mean, for Dennis here, there are certain, you know, evolution isn't as random, quote unquote, as some people make out, and in fact, it may be possible to see that it is a useful way in which God could fashion and intend for conscious creatures, whether they were exactly like Dennis, you and I, or not, but something that would be able to have that relationship with him. And I think Dennis sort of says, and then you've got to look at Scripture, which says, well, of course we were meant to be here. And so I guess that's the way he puts it together. But you're not happy that it's evolution for you still looks too random for that to be the case?
Well, I mean, I've actually been careful not to use the word random. I think that we start quibbling about terms, stochastic, chance, whatever. I mean, if I play the lottery and I buy one ticket and you play the lottery and buy 10, you have a 10 times better chance of winning. Still no guarantee you're going to win. So, of course, probabilistically speaking, certain things are more likely to happen than others. But there's nothing within the model as we understand it. I've actually just been doing some reading about the actual mechanisms for mutation, and it turns out there's a rich literature that thinks of the opinion that these are actually, at base, quantum events. And that is something that Dennis himself defines as a different type of authentic randomness, if he wants to use that word. And so at their base, I still think you have nothing here that predicts a particular outcome in a particular place. This actually greatly limits the predictive power of evolution. I mean, he keeps saying it's constrained. I guess I would disagree. I think you can show evidence of convergences on certain forms, but I don't think that there's any reason to think that if you reran the tape and did it again that you'd get these sorts of things. And he seems to sort of be saying something similar to what Ken Miller would say, which I think you have to consider theologically. He says, you know, we're no more intended or designed than a dandelion. Now, this is a theist, I guess a theistic evolutionist, if you like. And he said, you know, we're current winners, and we have to remind ourselves of that. And it could have been a big-brained dinosaur or a hyper-intelligent mollusk that gained intelligence in communion with God, in which I say, look, if you read the Bible and think that it was possible to have a molluscan Messiah, then that's your guy. But not, I don't think you get that from the Bible. I don't think it's just, well, yeah, somewhere in this big universe, something intelligent would arise, and that would be, they would be my people or whatever they are. I think that's really getting incredibly liberal with the understanding of how this all works. So I don't. I mean, I don't see. We're having a very hard time finding places we think are even habitable. And if they are, there's nothing that guarantees we'll get past simple prokaryotes as opposed to complex multicellular intelligent beings. Comet could erupt that could end that any time.
Yeah.
So,
Dennis.
Yes, I mean, I think we probably disagree about the, I think convergence itself, if you just take that one very remarkable phenomenon, which I just defined a few moments ago, where, you know, the same things, even the same biochemical pathways and so on, as you know, and I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of examples of that. That suggests that if you replay the tape of life again, that, you know, you tend to get the same stuff. And I actually think if we find life in other planets, which we might do, sadly, not in my lifetime probably, but, you know, I think it's going to be really boring for sci-fi enthusiasts, because I think it just might be, you know, it just like looks really remarkable to what we have here. As a matter of fact, I would say as a biochemist that I wouldn't surprise me a bit if the genetic code was very similar, even the same in other planets, and that's for good biochemical reasons. So, you know, I think the evidence we have, and is, yeah, you know, that we live in that the evolutionary process is very ordered and reproducible. Now, prediction is terribly hard, very hard with any kind of complex system. You know, we're talking about a really complex system. And so our human inability to predict under such circumstances is profound. You know, we have a very difficult time. But that's just a fact of our own, you know, puny minds and inability. I don't think that's anything. It doesn't tell us anything theological. It just tells us we're pretty limited, you know, in understanding the world around us. But I would like to pick up Adam and Eve.
Yeah, let's talk about Adam and Eve. Why don't we talk about that on the other side of a quick break? We're already moving along in terms of time. So we'd better go to a break and then we'll have time to talk about Adam and Eve. Covering a lot of ground on Unbelievable today, asking should Christians embrace or reject theistic evolution? Two different points of view with me, as ever. Wayne Rossiter was an atheist biologist, experienced an adult conversion to Christianity, but he changed his mind about evolution as well. It's related in his book Shadow of Oz. And if you want the other side of that coin, why not read Dennis Alexander's book as well? It's called Evolution versus what is the name of it again?
Creation or evolution? Do we have to choose?
Still available in imprint. I'll make sure there are links to both my guests and their books from today's program. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable, and we'll be back concluding this debate in a moment's time.
In July 2016, Unbelievable the Conference took place in London, a day for any Christian who struggles to share their faith with others.
I'm Justin Brierley, and I hosted a fantastic day of inspirational sessions with J. John, Gary Habermas, Beth Grove, and many others.
Now you've got the chance to watch and listen to over 12 hours of this empowering conference,
featuring evangelism, apologetics, and the resurrection.
Get your DVD at premier.org.uk/shop and become a confident evangelist today.
Welcome back to the third and final part of this week's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and discussion, conversations that matter, and in fact, the conversation between two Christians on the programme today, and we'll be concluding that one between Wayne Rossiter and Dennis Alexander in just a moment's time. Frank Turek and David Smalley to join me next week. Now, they're both US guests. Frank Turek, a well-known Christian apologist, author, and radio host of the Cross-Examined talk show out in the States. Well, David Smalley, kind of his opposite in the sense that he is the host of the Dogma Debate show, which is an atheist talk show out in the States. And they're both going to be joining me on another radio show to debate the question whether atheists have been stealing from God. Now, this is the title of Frank Turek's most recent book, Stealing from God, Why Atheists Steal from God in Order to Make Their Case. And they're going to be talking about reason and logic. Have atheists stolen reason and logic from a Christian worldview in order to make their case against God? So that should be a fun one for next week, if you can come back to the programme. Another reminder that Unbelievable the Conference, if you're wanting to find out more about it, the theme this year is Why Christ? Discover how Jesus is the answer to life, the universe and everything. Ticketing now open. premier.org.uk/whychrist. Could you join us on Saturday, the 13th of May in London? We had such a good time last year. A little bit earlier on in the year this time, on the 13th of May. But I do hope if you were there, you'll come back. And if you haven't been before, you'll try it out. It's great to get people along. I'm so looking forward to being joined again by John Lennox, well known as a Christian thinker and speaker. He's obviously professor of mathematics at Oxford University, widely published author, has debated people like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins in the past. And he's always good fun, a great value, John. And he, I'm sure, will be popping up on the programme between then and now. Andy Bannister as well will be there. Beth Grove, who was a huge hit last year's conference talking about engaging Muslims, and lots more besides. Check out what's there already on the website at premier.org.uk/whychrist. And I'll be launching my book at the conference as well. I've been teasing this for quite a long time, haven't I? But my book, Unbelievable, Why, After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. I will be speaking at my own conference for the first time in a slot. And you'll be able to hear all about the journey of Unbelievable over the last 10, 11 years and where I've ended up. So look forward to seeing you there if you can make it. Do spread the word around. And it'll be great to meet lots of unbelievable listeners again this year. Just a quick mention as well for the informal sort of monthly discussion group that happens in London, the Skeptic and Christian Discussion Group organised by Ed Atkinson, happening at Somerstown Coffee House, 60 Cholton Street, on the 13th of February at 7:30. Heather Tomlinson going to be speaking on Are Human Beings Fundamentally Good? If you want to get yourself along to that, the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptics Discussion Group, check out the details at the meetup.com website. Just look for Unbelievable Skeptic and Christian Discussion Group and you'll be able to see more about it there. We'll be hearing some of your feedback as we conclude today's programme. But first of all, let's conclude our discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, it's been a really interesting discussion on today's programme. Wayne Rossiter has joined me. He's the author of Shadow of Oz, a book where he claims Christians have been sold a theological, philosophical and biological fallacy about Christianity's supposed compatibility with Darwinian evolution. Now, we haven't really discussed the scientific aspects of this, but certainly that's something that Wayne goes into in quite a lot of detail in the book as well. We've been really kind of focusing really on the theological aspects of this and whether fundamentally the Darwinian paradigm is opposed to a classical understanding of a Christian God. That's certainly something that Wayne says in the book. He says the reason is plain and obvious. Something cannot be intended and unintended at the same time. He says we kind of lay ourselves wide open to atheists who will say this just looks like an ad hoc theory on your part, Christians, when you come along and claim that your God is behind this obviously very naturalistic looking process. Now, Wayne doesn't believe in the process itself. He thinks there's a lot of holes in that theory, but on a theological level has a lot of issues with it. We'll come back to this in a moment's time. Dennis Alexander is responding in favor of theistic evolution today. We just when we got to the end of that section, we wanted to talk about Adam and Eve as well, because again, Wayne sort of had hazarded a kind of a guess at where you stood on that issue, not believing in an original pair. I don't know what I think you have told me in the past, though, on this program, that you're open to the idea of a pair who were gifted with God consciousness or something like that. I don't know if that's where you take it, Dennis.
No, yes, I take a rather literal view, actually, the Adam and Eve account, in the sense that not as progenitors of the whole of humanity, but I think the early chapters of Genesis are primarily theological accounts, but I think we can think about scenarios where, you know, if we were there with our lab notebook, we might be able to write down what we actually saw, which I think is what Wayne is trying to, is sort of interested in. I mean, I would see, you know, one model which I find quite attractive is one which goes back, you mentioned earlier, John Stott here in London, the Reverend John Stott, the rector of All Souls, Langham Place, sadly now no longer with us. But, you know, he came up with this language, homo divinus, the divine humans, with the thought that, well, maybe what's going on here is that God takes a couple or community, a couple, let's say, of Near East Neolithic farmers or whatever, perhaps 8,000-10,000 years ago, and reveals himself to them in a particular way to bring them into fellowship with himself. So these are real people, real physical people, real time, real farmers. And this is the beginning of God's new family on earth, those who are brought to God by faith because they now understand God sufficiently to be able to pray. And the fall is then represented by the disobedience of this couple, this community, maybe to the will of God for their lives and the understanding that they had to care for the earth and to look after the earth and to pray, to fellowship.
But that fall wouldn't introduce the kind of physical effects that Wayne has been concerned about in terms of evolution, because of course that had to be there for them to be there in the first place, you know, the cycle of death and life and change and evolution over time.
Absolutely, yes. So this model, if you like, gets us right away in a way from evolutionary process. It says, well, yeah, evolution is necessary and sufficient for us to have big frontal lobes, big brains, so we have the ability to have language and you know, have relationships and culture and so forth. But, you know, as today, it's not sufficient for spiritual life. So spiritual life is a gift of God. And the argument then is that it was a gift of God to Adam and Eve at the beginning to bring them into fellowship with himself. in the same way, if you like, that today, you know, you wander around the streets of London or wherever you are, and you can't tell just by looking at people if they have spiritual life or not. You know, you just can't tell that. You know, so everyone physically are the same, but they need to be born again. They need to have spiritual life with God.
And Wayne, does that tally with kind of where you thought Dennis stood on Adam and Eve? And what's your best guess as to how you would put that together?
Yeah, the Homo Divinus hypothesis or model has been, you know, I've read that in several different places. I've talked about it in my book. I guess what I would say, and again, this sort of just seems like poking, but so God steps in for a particular pair, some couple, 8,000 to 10,000 years ago, and gives them a spiritual life. I guess I'm wondering if I'm a descendant of somebody else that wasn't from them, because there were lots of humans around. Apparently, they weren't going to be held morally culpable for their actions, and they don't have the spiritual life that pair was given. And so it creates a really strange situation, since we don't think that there were two original progenitors to all humanity. Then it's presumably we have humanity today that wasn't from them. Which I find interesting.
But. Yeah, it is interesting. You're right, Wayne. Thank you. I see the idea goes back into the in Reformed theology, and you go back to Calvin and people like that. You have this idea of federal headship, which is picked up actually by the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 5, where Paul says, "As in Adam will die, so in Christ shall all be made alive." So. And as a matter of fact, Paul actually calls calls Adam the typos of Christ, the type of Christ. So you get this theological idea coming through that Christ is the federal head of all those who come to faith through him and come into his new family. Well, so Paul is making this parallel with Adam, that through him all people fall. As in Adam will die, so in Christ shall all be made alive. Now, Paul is very careful to point out in Romans 5 that there are also a number of disparallels, things that are not the same between Christ and Adam. And, of course, one is that we have to put our faith in Christ in order to enter his kingdom. And clearly that wasn't the case for the fall. But the sort of analogy is there, I think, in Paul's mind. So as Adam falls, so humanity falls with him. And clearly in Genesis 3, you get a strong idea. There are plenty of other humans around in the Genesis story. That's pretty clear. You know, Cain was running off. He was scared of getting killed, and there were cities around. So, you know, the Genesis text itself does not suggest that Adam and Eve were the only humans around.
I mean, where do you land yourself in terms of this stuff? Because do you find that the general story of the evolutionary history of human beings, as typically shown to us, Wayne, militates against a kind of a good Christian understanding of the fall and sin and Christ dying in our place and that kind of thing?
Right. Well, I mean, so I'm not a young earth creationist. Mm-hmm. And so I am open to any of the competing theories basically I would say if I, you know, put me in a lie detector, I think Homo sapiens, as we understand them, show up 182,000 years ago. Those are sort of modern hominids. And then we have something that 12,000 years ago represents sort of the birth of civilization. Mm-hmm. I guess I've never understood the whole qualm with having something called an Adam and an Eve as two progenitors to humanity. I mean, within science, we routinely talk about a mitochondrial Eve, whatever represents the female that gives rise to all females we see today. And if we can do that biologically speaking, I don't see why we can't adapt that theologically speaking. Now, there are problems with that, don't get me wrong, and it still requires, but see, I'm not against supernatural interaction. I'm not against God stepping in and taking a primate ancestor into somewhere new to create something or do something new given the materials that are there. And I think that kind of gets at whether or not I think Darwinian evolution is sufficient, and I'd like to at least make a statement about that before we end. I don't know if now's the time, but
Now's as good a time as any. So go ahead, yeah.
Well, I think that if we've learned anything in the last, well, I would say 20 years, maybe 40 years since the 60s and 70s, it's that it's not enough. I mean, Darwinian evolution is there, but it's not the only game in town. I mean, the Royal Society met in November to talk about this. We have really legitimate scholars, biologists, thinkers, offering completely scientific hypotheses that involve lots of other mechanisms. And these are much more compatible to theism. this begins from the beginning, most people will say, well, the origin of life doesn't matter to evolution. Of course it matters. If you have a thing that was built for a reason as some sort of problem-solving algorithm, that's different than a random bumbling of molecules that somehow start copying themselves. If you start with an intention, you end with an intention. And there are lots of competing hypotheses about what that even looks like at the beginning. And then, I mean, there are some theistic evolutionists. Joshua Swamidas is one. He greatly denies the power of Darwinian evolution to explain evolutionary patterns. He relies on something called neutral theory. James Shapiro has front-loading, and Kirshner and Gerhardt, I could just start name-dropping, Kirshner and Gerhardt like facilitated adaptation. You have Kaufman's emergent theories, which I like a lot. There are lots of competing hypotheses that either augment or replace Darwinian evolution, and they're legitimate. They're not just dreamt-up creationist stories. And so I would say I'm not so quick to jump on the bandwagon and hook my chain to Darwin if it's going down.
And yeah, this is, as I say, some of the scientific material you cover in the book. It's interesting. I've heard a lot, you know, of talk about this conference that took place in November. In fact, planning to get Steve Meyer and one or two others in conversation about it in the not too distant future. They were there. I guess my question is, though, and maybe Dennis, you'd like to take a pop at this. I mean, would it fundamentally change things if it turned out the kind of neo-Darwinian paradigm wasn't the only game in town and that there were other competing hypotheses? I guess we'd still be looking at evolution of some kind going on, even if it's not as naturalistic necessarily on the face of it as we would otherwise.
Well, I know Dennis wants to jump in.
But go ahead.
I'll just quickly just real quick. I actually think that's an important point. Mm. I don't know any Christian who doesn't claim some form of evolution. Even if you're a young earth creationist, a Ken Ham type, you believe that there were kinds that were created originally and that they diversify into the 8 to 9 million species we see today. Mm-hmm. There is clearly a biological descendant evolution there, even for the young earth creationist. So in that sense, I don't think we're trying to hide from the E word. Mm-hmm. I think we're asking what it is.
Okay. Do you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, sure, yes. I mean, you're absolutely right, Wayne. I mean, there's a lovely discussions going on about the process of evolution and so forth. I mean, I think all theories evolve, don't they? All theories change. And if you look at, even if you just look at straightforward, good old Darwinian theory, the neo-Darwinian theory, it's a very different theory from the theory that it was in 1859. So because we have obviously, we've got genetics, we've got population genetics, we've got the neo-Darwinian synthesis where natural selection was sort of baptized into population genetics. And so the theory is on a move. Yeah, I'm sure it is. And
do you think it could come to a point where God has a bit more of a direct role in it?
Well, this won't please Wayne. You see, I just see it all part of the created order. You see,
right.
When we scientists, when we try out with our different scientific theories, I mean, nearly all of them are wrong if you take a very long-term view, you know, or else they get adjusted or they change, you know. So this is our feeble efforts, you know, to understand the mind of God. So, you know, we're going to be limited on this, let's face it. And they are going to change. And sometimes they maybe look more amenable to theistic understanding of the world, and maybe sometimes less. At the moment, I think Wayne is absolutely right. I mean, I think the way the theory is going right now, it looks a much more comfortable theory, I think, for Christians to hold, actually, much more comfortable than it was a few decades ago. So I think we're in agreement, actually, on this.
I was just going to say, if it turns out that random isn't as random or chance isn't as chance, then I think suddenly Dennis and I will have a lot of agreement.
No. Yeah, I think. Well, I think there may be some convergence here, Wayne. I think so.
You were going to say something to start to wrap up there, I think, Dennis.
What was I going to say? Oh, well, I think. Just that. Even the things are at the moment, you see, I personally, taking the process as a whole, this is where I agree with Richard Dawkins in the preface to The Blind Watchmaker, where he says, one reason I write this book is to persuade you evolution is not a theory of chance. Okay. So I agree with Dawkins on that particular point. Let me emphasize, not on other points. Okay. So the point here is, you know, if you look at the process as a whole, if you look at the individual organism, you know, then clearly you can't predict where it's going to go. But if you look at the process as a whole, there are themes, there are processes which are very ordered and which are very rational. And you can, I think there will be laws of evolution that emerge eventually once we understand the process better, actually. We'll even start talking about laws in biology. We don't normally do that.
Well, thank you very much for being with me, Dennis, here in studio. Wayne, thank you for being on the line. Anything you want to add just as we close out today's program?
No, it's always nice when we can end sort of agreeing a bit. So I really appreciate the opportunity, and it's great. This is the first time I've talked with Dennis, and I appreciate interacting with him and look forward to doing it again sometime.
Yeah, great.
Likewise.
Well, let me remind you again, the books that you want to be getting hold of if you want to pursue this further, certainly Wayne Rossiter's book, Shadow of Oz, links from today's program, and of course Dennis Alexander's Creation or Evolution, Do We Have to Choose? Links to both my guests and their books from today's program, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Thanks, gentlemen. Really fascinating discussion. It always is when I have you in, Dennis, and really good to make your acquaintance as well, Wayne, and all the very best to you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
I look forward to receiving your feedback about today's programme. As ever, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, tweet me @unbelievablejb, or follow on Facebook, facebook.com/unbelievablejb. All of those links available from today's programme as well, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Or you can equally leave a comment underneath today's show. Lots of people do that as well. Always a lively comment section underneath every show. As for commentary on last week's programme, the gloves came off between David Marshall and Richard Carrier on this question of the historicity of Jesus. And, if you listen back to that programme, you'll know that the perhaps more heat generated than light, I don't know. But in any case, one of the main things that came out of that was a blog post by both parties, Richard Carrier and David Marshall, reflecting on the debate. And, well, Richard Carrier did not pull his punches. David Marshall's bizarre and dishonest defence of the historicity of Jesus was how he titled his blog, beginning it with, "Liars disgust me, and David Marshall flat out lied about my work on public radio. He should be ashamed." Had some nice words to say about me, which is nice. I really like Justin Brierley as a host. I've done his Unbelievable show several times. He's sharp, asks good questions, quickly gets to the point and focuses the discussion. This time I was invited to engage David Marshall on his new book, Jesus is No Myth. The book is absolutely face-palmingly awful. Now, Richard Carrier did draw some criticism for a line in his post in which he said, David Marshall, "Anyone who's going to lie like that effectively to my face in public before an audience of thousands and not even correct or apologise for it is a disgusting person who can go die in a fire." Well, he did draw some criticism for that, defended himself, but did delete that particular phrase in what is now available from his website, richardcarrier.info. Obviously, David Marshall responded as well with a post titled on his website, "Thank you, Richard Carrier, but I don't think I'll die in a fire today." And humorously posts a picture of the Incredible Hulk and says, "I know two men named Richard Carrier. One obtained his PhD in the history of Greco-Roman science or some such topic from one of the leading universities in the world. That Richard Carrier is capable of gushing historiographical aphorisms, is well read, recognizes the value and some of the characteristics of social scholarship. The other seems to be a raving lunatic." They can carry that on in their own blogospheres. Thank you as well for those who have been in touch about that program via the Facebook page and underneath that show. Lots and lots of comments underneath that show if you want to go and check it out for yourself on the website. But I wanted to focus on some of the stuff that came in regards to that great conversation between Randall Rouser and Justin Sheba, who were talking about religious disagreement. Is the fact that there are so many different versions and views of God and religion around the world evidence against there being a God? Should God have sort of made everyone believe approximately the same thing about that? So here's a few responses. This one, first of all, Darren, who quite often emails me, a very strong atheist, doesn't hold back in the way he puts things across. "Sounds like the main difference between Justin and Randall is that Justin is assuming a God that is loving, or Randall believes in an bleep God that tells the different religions to kill each other. Anyone arrogant enough to reject the verdict of the judge or of the priest who represents the Lord your God must be put to death," you say, quoting from Deuteronomy. and so on. So that's Darren's point of view. Mike Klein says, thanks so much for your show. It truly has been a blessing for me. I've been working my way through your past podcasts and have made it back to your 2010 shows. I found the last two shows really interesting because one of my oldest and dearing friends is a lifelong atheist and I'm a lifelong Christian. How the son of an atheist college professor and the son of a minister happened to become childhood and then lifelong friends is anybody's guess. Anyway, there's a discovery that I made while in college that I think speaks directly to the discussion about religious disagreement. When studying Native American cultures of the Northwest, I learned about the history of local tribes. When the white settlers came to the Northwest, they found it very easy to convert the Northwest Indians to faith in Christ. When my professor told me this, I asked him why. He didn't actually know, but offered an educated guess that it was because the settlers had firearms and they were seen as powerful and therefore better than the Native Americans, and the Native Americans adopted Christianity in an effort to share in the power they saw in the settlers. It wasn't until later that I learned of the Native American legend of the Raven and the Sky King. In this myth, the raven is trying to steal the sun from the Sky King, so he turns himself into a pine needle and falls into a bowl of water which the virgin daughter of the Sky King drinks. The virgin daughter becomes pregnant and gives birth to a little boy who then steals the sun from the Sky King and then brings light to the world. My feeling is that this story so closely mirrors that of the story of Christ, virgin birth, God raven becoming man, salvation from darkness. It's my theory that this similarity is why the Native Americans of the Northwest were so easily converted to Christianity. So even though there were major differences in the religions of Christians and Native Americans, God saw fit to put enough similarities in each of those belief systems to allow the Native Americans to accept Christianity when it was offered to them. Thank you, Mike. It sort of sounds along the lines of what I think was mentioned in that program, the idea, you know, that C.S. Lewis had, that all ideas about God, myths, if you like, that seem to have elements of the Christian narrative are pointing forward or backwards or whatever to the true story of God. David on this says, was good to have Justin Sheba back on the show. Been long overdue, and Randall has become one of my favourite Christian guests. The discussion was very easily listening, thanks to the respectful tone of the participants, which is a trademark of the podcast. Just wanted to say the email section at the end of the show was basically another closing statement in favour of Justin's argument on religious disagreement, as it was littered with Christian theists contacting you to say how much they disagreed with a previous Christian guest of yours' theological interpretation. Serendipitous. And David Rigg says, thanks for Unbelievable. I've become a regular podcast listener over the past year. I didn't have time to read all the comments, but I did look through them fairly quickly. It seems so far no one's considered what to me is an obvious point of view. And this, by the way, is from the comments section underneath that show between Sheba and Rouser. The analogy of a landlord was put forward, with the conclusion that if there was a landlord, he wasn't doing very well because he revealed contradictory things about himself. The landlord was representing God. The idea then was that God was going around to the different cultures, telling them differing things about himself, and that's untenable, and therefore there's no God. But I would propose that if God is the landlord, there's also a usurper who's trying to take his place, collect his rents, and even defames him on a regular basis. Jesus gave the parable of the absent landlord and those that wanted to take his place. There are other biblical parallels to that as well, even if they don't use the landlord metaphor. If this is the case, then I wouldn't be at all surprised to find differing concepts of God, because most of them would be from the usurper. I would maintain that it isn't wise to try to come up with a composite God from various religious traditions, as seem to be suggested. If this is the way it truly is, then there's only one true revelation. And just a quick one from Catherine Bale, who said, Randall Rouser talked about the importance of acquaintance knowledge and said the following: if you have Asperger's syndrome, there's a much higher likelihood you won't believe in God's existence, and that seems to be in part due to your cognitive wiring, that there is an inability to conceive of an abstract non-physical being, let alone conceive of yourself relating to that being. This isn't true. I believe in God, and I'm autistic. I'm a Christian, and I have a real relationship with God. I know a lot of people who are also autistic and both believe in and relate to God. The misconception that we're unable to believe in God can be harmful, so I'd like to offer this alternative perspective. Thank you very much, and thanks to all who have been in touch about this last couple of weeks of programming. And thank you for listening to today's show. Can I tell you what's coming up on the show next week?
You're unbelievable.
Frank Turek and David Smalley go at it. Frank Turek, Christian apologist and host of Cross Examined radio show. David Smalley, host of the Dogma Debate atheist show. Have atheists been stealing from God? That's what they're debating next week. Hope you can join me for that. In the meantime, I'll say goodbye. Hand over to Sam Hales with the profile.